Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Anne Kruger. Anne is Professor of International Economics at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and former First Deputy Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. We met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in New Orleans in January 2008, where Anne presented a paper on trade liberalisation and growth in developing countries, as part of the series on better living through economics. I began by asking her about the backlash against globalisation that we've seen in some circles in recent years, and where she comes in on the debate about the costs and benefits of increased economic integration.
Well, I come in somewhat astonished, I suppose would be the correct answer, because I used to take it absolutely as a given that living standards had risen enormously over the past couple of centuries, that mankind was an awful lot better off, that we'd even begun getting some positive momentum in developing countries, and that a big chunk of that was attributable to the fact that indeed there'd been more economic integration, really since about 1800. And so what's astonished me was when people worry about globalization. Clearly, whenever there's economic growth, things have to change and adapt, and that's certainly true here as elsewhere. But 200 years ago, most people didn't move more than 5 or 10 miles from where they were born at any point in their lifetime. Most of what they consumed was basically provided within the village. And most of them voted with their feet against that lifestyle because they found something much better. And much of that has had to do with falling transport costs, falling costs of communication, and what that's enabled. And life expectancies are vastly greater than they were. Living standards are very different. And why people are so worried about globalization is something that has really been going on a long, long time. And people who want to stay in the village can do so.
So, in your astonishment, do you really think there is a serious threat, or do you think that we have to get a strong message out to say, come and look at these benefits?
I think the discussion is frightening because I think it shows an absolute lack of comprehension of what the progress has been over the past couple of centuries. I saw some economic historians are now estimating that living standards and real wages in Britain were about the same in 1800 as 1200. The ups and downs, big cycles, but no change. And, of course, now they're about 20 times that. Life expectancy was about the same in 1200 as in 1800, again, in Britain. And 35, 38 years, something like that, if I recall correctly. Of course, now it's in the 70s. I can't imagine that people want to say that this is something they don't want. Now, all of that's happened, and there have always been problems along the way. It hasn't been a smooth process, and, of course, there are problems to be addressed in the countries that are well advanced of the process and countries that are in the rear guard, but that doesn't mean the process itself is one that should be challenged as much as it is, so much as we always had things that we needed to do to make life better along the way, and governance is part of it.
Do you think it's been partly a problem of communication that we as economists have been the ones that have been proponents of the benefit and showed the benefits, but we haven't got the message out effectively enough?
Well, certainly it's frightening the extent to which I think people don't understand how much better off they are than their forebears were three or four or five or six generations ago. And it's scary almost the degree to which people in rich countries don't understand what genuine poverty is. Relative to one of the interesting statistics I came across was that in 1900, by today's poverty standards in the United States, there were 6% of Americans who were not poor, which I think is an interesting statistic to tell you how far we've come now. Of course, our poverty standard has risen over time, too, and it isn't true that 94% of Americans in 1900 thought they were poor, but by today's standards, they were.
So, really, the sort of anti-globalization movement is a phenomenon of the developed world, isn't it?
It's the phenomenon of the rich.
But in a sense, some of the case they're making, or some portion of that movement, are saying, "Well, we need to care about it's the developing countries that are going to suffer." But in reality, it's our own lifestyles that people worry about. Is that right?
I mean, it's both, of course. I mean, any move to fracture the world into different blocks or something like that is going to hurt everybody. But the ones that will be hurt the most are the ones who so far have not taken advantage of globalization as much as they might, and who would otherwise have had a chance or would anyway try to integrate when indeed the payoffs wouldn't be as great because of these counter movements, if that's the right word.
What are the key elements of globalization that you see, Anne? I mean, trade liberalization is obviously a core thing.
Well, trade was clearly the most important. In the 19th century, and the evidence says until at least 1913 and maybe 1945, The big driver was the fall in transport and communications costs. So transport costs on oceans were some 2 or 3% of what they'd been two centuries before. And I mean, that opened up a lot of things. And the same with rail, the same with other forms of shipping. And of course, what's the statistic? A 3-minute phone call between London and New York cost something like $200 in the 2000 crisis in 1930. And of course, now you use the internet and you forget, maybe if it's cost a penny, but you don't even think about it. And so much of this has changed in ways that people don't appreciate. And yet that's been crucial to it. What happened was that by the end of the Second World War and thereabouts, transport and communications costs had already fallen so much. The trade barriers that were put up by governments, tariffs and other barriers to trade were more important. But through the GATT and the WTO, they came down, and so they continued this trend of lowering the costs of trading at a distance. And that's enabled a lot of things that couldn't happen before.
So where are we now with trade liberalization? Do you think things are going to move forward, or are we rather at an impasse in that process?
That's an interesting question. Certainly, relative to, let's say, 1950, trade in industrial goods throughout the world is much liberalized, with a few exceptions, of course, Myanmar and places like that have just stayed out of it. But that's gone in any positive way. Trade in agriculture has lagged way behind for reasons everybody, I think, knows. But the thing is, of course, with continuing progress, there are new problems. And intellectual property rights, which weren't much of a problem earlier on, are now. Big pharmas, and trade in services is much bigger than it was. You wouldn't have dreamt of some of these services being traded 30 years ago. Architects couldn't have sent their plans overnight by email or what have you, and now that's possible. So we need whole new accords or concords or whatever you want to call it between countries so that we can get as meaningful and as productive an exchange in the new lines as we did in the old.
How do issues of the environment fit into this? Because, I mean, the World Trade Organization has been pretty effective, hasn't it, in creating a sort of international agreement about trade, and we hope there's going to be progress going forward. But the environmental issues are now, very high on the agenda, aren't they?
I listen to the environmental discussions with lots of reactions. One, of course, I'm rich, and so I love a good environment, so I'm all for it. And the more we do, the better. But on the other hand, not everybody's rich, and some people can't afford some of it. And I think there's a real risk that some of the things that are being pushed by some of the pro-environmental groups, whom I otherwise respect enormously, are leading to backlash in developing countries precisely because they say, well, you spoiled your environment and got rich, now you just don't want us to do so. And I think that's a real problem. That said, then I have mixed feelings too. People say, well, why don't we tie the environment to trade? Well, that's a problem. Because trade is so important and what have you, but we don't have a world government. And so there are environment issues. And then I listen to people who have discovered there are spillovers and that, yes, it does matter what's happening in the rest of the world. And to me, that's positive because sometimes people talk as if you could ignore it completely. So I have very conflicted feelings about that.
Now, you've, over many years, looked at trade liberalization in many different countries around the world. What do you see as the great success stories and what have been the failures? And what are the lessons we learn from that?
Well, I mean, first off, I don't think there's been a successful case of sustained, by which I mean more than a decade or two, of sustained well above average growth in any country that hasn't, in that process, opened up to trade very, very substantially. So the first thing to be said is that if you want to divide the world into those who've done better and those who've done worse, you'd find those who have been more open had on average done better, even if you took into account their natural resources and stuff like that. So that's the first thing. The second thing, though, is that the big spectacular successes have been places such as Korea, which is one of the most spectacular, where it was the third poorest country in Asia, had really, I think, the highest density of population on the land of any country in the world, had a negative savings rate, totally dependent on foreign aid and what have you in 1960, switched policies, and of course now is talked about as an industrial country. Life expectancy in Korea is now 1 year less than it is in the UK, whereas in 1960, life expectancy in Korea was about 30 years. So I would have said that was the biggest success, but then we've had some others. Chile's done fairly well since they opened up in a Latin American context. They've certainly done better than many more, but not as spectacular. The Korean drive for growth was really sort of the sole focus of political and economic attention for years, and it really paid off. Singapore and Hong Kong, of course, have done spectacularly well as well. Of course, Taiwan is in there, and some of the Southeast Asian countries. And now, of course, everybody's talking about China, although there's still a long way to go there before they could be regarded as being in the same middle income group as some of the ones that started earlier.
What do you see as the role of institutions, both the political institutions within countries in facilitating growth, liberalization, and the role of the kind of organizations that you've been involved in, the international organizations?
Well, the first thing to be said is I think that there are windows of opportunity, and having the right people there sometimes gets things going. I don't think the entire Korean populace was supportive of trade liberalization. I think trade liberalization began having payoffs and people got behind it. So I think it's a two-way street in that regard. And I think it differs from country to country. I don't think that there's one... certainly South Korea in 1960 was not a model of governance. In fact, there was a military overthrow of the government because it was so corrupt. Within 2 or 3 years, there were elections and so on and so forth, and then it went back to military. But there seemed to be a strong societal consensus that they wanted growth above all else. But it had been demonstrated to them what the payoffs were. In different countries, it's different. There's a lot of skepticism that came, I think, out of the belief that the central planning was highly successful. And a lot of people don't seem to have realized yet that even the central planners now recognize that it wasn't. And I think that's something that is still to be factored into many people's accounts or sort of understandings of the world. But I think there are windows of opportunity with new governments. And having, so to speak, a blueprint ready at that time by the technocrats can make the difference between success and failure in terms of being able to open up to the appropriate or more appropriate policies.
Final question, Anne. Would you consider yourself optimistic or pessimistic about the prospects for the future for greater liberalization, greater globalization and growth of some of these poorer countries
in
the world?
Well, we know that there can be huge setbacks a la the 1930s. On the other hand, I have to believe and I think that markets by and large have had enough of a payoff. That yes, there may be minor setbacks, but on the whole, there will be enough that's beneficial to win out to prevent a real retrogression of the system. So I guess I'm optimistic.
Anne Kruger, many thanks.